Welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from the Associated Press, from the Washington Post, from the New York Times, and more. This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And podcasts of this broadcast, as well as other Religion in the News episodes, may be found on our website at ncreadingservice.org. We begin this week on Religion in the News with an article from the Associated Press dated March 18th. This article is entitled, "In Pope's Homeland, Ex-Priest Leaves Church Over Gay Unions." And this is by Deborah Ray of the Associated Press, Dayline Buenos Aires. A former priest, an LGBTQ activist who has blessed same-sex unions in Pope Francis's home country, Argentina, is leaving the Roman Catholic Church after the Vatican issued a pronouncement this week that priests may not perform such blessings. Andres Gioani delivered a letter disavowing his faith to the bishopric in Buenos Aires suburb on Wednesday, the anniversary of his ordination as a priest in 2000, and 2 days after the declaration from the Holy See. "I do not want to continue being an accomplice to this institution, because I realize the harm they are doing to people. I am not renouncing my faith in God, but rather I am renouncing a role and a right," said Gioani, age 49. He spoke in an interview with the Associated Press at the home he shares with his husband, 50-year-old Luis Airochi, and their 3 dogs, a few blocks from the cathedral in San Isidro, north of the capital. Like other LGBTQ Catholics, Gioani was shocked by Monday's proclamation, which argued that clergy members cannot bless same-sex unions on the grounds that they are not part of the divine plan and God cannot bless sin. The Vatican says LGBTQ people should be treated with dignity and respect, but that gay sex is intrinsically disordered and same-sex unions are sinful. The declaration from the Holy See's Orthodoxy Office, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, was authorized by Francis, who prior to assuming the papacy supported legal protection for gay people in civil unions in the country as Cardinal Jorge Mario Bergoglio, Archbishop of Buenos Aires. "There is no mention in any book of the Bible of consensual love between two people of the same sex and God telling them no," said Gioani, who has blessed at least 4 such unions. Born in Mendoza province, some 600 miles or 1,000 kilometers west of Buenos Aires, Gioani pursued a religious vocation as a young man, despite being tormented by doubts about his sexuality. He even outed to his superiors 3 fellow seminarians who had confessed attraction to him. "All throughout seminary, I was terribly homophobic," Gioani said. "It was a defense." After ordination, he rose quickly in the provincial church while secretly exploring chat rooms for the local gay community. He had his first sexual encounter with another man, broke it off to continue the priesthood, but then saw the man again. Gioani told the bishop he needed to leave. The church did not offer him psychological help, just a room next to the organ of the Buenos Aires Cathedral, where he was to confront his supposed crisis of faith. "That was my descent into hell. There I realized that I was considered like the Hunchback of Notre Dame, a defective being who could not go out into the world because he would be criticized and singled out," Gioani recalled. Gioani's superiors became aware of his sexual identity in 2003 when he appeared nude on the cover of a gay magazine and barred him from exercising priestly ministry. He studied acting and worked as a waiter in a disco where he met Airochi. Together for 17 years now, they wed after Argentina became the first Latin American nation to legalize same-sex marriage in 2010. In recent years, Gioani has become an LGBTQ activist, lobbying for a more open Catholic Church. "Severing formal ties with the institution doesn't change his faith in God," he said. "I continue believing in God, and he will be my God. In that, my spirituality is unchanged," Gioani said. "I no longer have a label. What religion are you? I believe in God." We'll turn next to an article from the Washington Post, and this article dated March 17th. Christian leaders wrestle with Atlanta shooting suspects' Southern Baptist ties. And this is by Sarah Pulliam Bailey and Teo Armas of the Washington Post. Years before being suspected of killing 8 people in a suburb of Atlanta, including 6 Asian women, Robert Aaron Long was active in his Southern Baptist congregation, his youth pastor said Wednesday. Long, age 21, was arrested Tuesday in connection with the three shootings. As a teenager, Long would stack chairs and clean floors at Crabapple First Baptist Church in Milton, Georgia, said Brett Cottrell, who led the youth ministry at Crabapple from 2008 to 2017. Long's father was considered an important lay leader in the church, Cottrell said, and they would attend morning and evening activities on Sundays, as well as meetings on Wednesday evenings and mission trips. "There's nothing that I'm aware of at Crabapple that would give approval to this," Cottrell said in an interview referring to the shootings. "I'm assuming it's as shocking and numbing to them as it has been to me." Cottrell said he viewed a 2018 video of Long describing his conversion to the Christian faith at around 8 years old when he was baptized. Cottrell considered him a typical teenager growing up in the suburbs of Atlanta. "It's not unusual for young men to be into video games," Cottrell said. "Was he around guns and hunting? Yeah. Would I consider him to be obsessed? No. Was it part of his life? Yeah. At that time, I wouldn't classify it as one of the main things he was involved in. Had he been deer hunting? Yeah. I don't know that I would have considered it to be a massive chunk of his life." But during those teenage years, Cottrell said, the church youth group was his deal, and Long was part of a high school group that met for Bible study once a week before school and helped a backyard Bible club with songs and games for kids. Cottrell said the church was predominantly white, but included several people of Asian and African descent. "I don't recall any sermons dealing specifically with racism, but the general tenor was to welcome and to be as inclusive as possible," he said. In a statement to the Washington Post, church elders at Crabapple First Baptist said they were heartbroken about the tragic news about the multiple deaths in the Atlanta area. "We grieve for the victims and their families, and we continue to pray for them," the statement said. "Moreover, we are distraught for the Long family and continue to pray for them as well." Cottrell said he did not know whether Long still attends the church or when he last attended services. According to a video that was captured by the Post before it was deleted, on Sunday the church's pastor, the Reverend Jerry Dockery, gave a sermon on the apocalypse. "Christ was coming soon," Dockery said, "and the world must be ready." "We've had, what, 45 presidents in our brief history as a nation? How many other kings around the world? How many other rulers have sat upon thrones claiming to be in charge?" he asked. "The king is coming again." When Christ returns, Dockery said, he will wage war against those who have rejected his name. "There is one word devoted to their demise," the pastor said, "swept away, banished, judged. They have no power before God. Satan himself is bound and released and then bound again and banished. That great dragon deceiver, just that quickly, God throws him into an eternal torment. And then we read where everyone that rejects Christ, will join Satan, the beast, and the false prophet in hell." It is not uncommon for pastors to preach on the apocalypse, and it's unclear whether Long heard the pastor's teaching Sunday. Police said Long told them he had a sex addiction, and authorities said he apparently lashed out at what he saw as sources of temptation. The church has deleted its social media pages, including ones on which Long appeared in photos and in videos. The congregation held a members-only meeting on Wednesday night. Long has told police the shootings were not racially motivated. But Melissa May Borgia, a religion scholar in the Department of American Culture at the University of Michigan, said that it's important for people not to just consider his intent, but also his impact. "Maybe he didn't intend to harm Asian Americans, but it's clearly had a disparate impact on Asian American women," she said, adding that women doing the work in the spas like the ones Long targeted tend to be economically vulnerable and the targets of harassment. "Considering the structure of labor does mean they probably were more likely the target of a white man dealing with issues of sex and shame," she said. "Maybe he saw these women as more expendable." In recent weeks, many Asian Americans have become accustomed to hearing about violence, said Michelle Reyes, vice president of the Asian American Christian Collaborative. But Reyes said Tuesday's attacks have left many in her community, including Indian Americans, reeling. "I hope that it can be a turning point in talking about Asian women in particular," Reyes said. "It feels very personal." Christian leaders across the nation have condemned the shootings, calling for more work to combat sexism and racism in churches. In 2019, before he allegedly walked into a synagogue in Poway, California, and opened fire, John Ernest was a churchgoer who wrote about his evangelical theology. Russell Moore, head of the Southern Baptist Convention's public policy arm, called the shooting shocking, and he has been increasingly hearing from Asian Americans about escalating immoral and unjust bigotry. Christians must also lead the way in refusing to listen and refusing to amplify the voices of those who would incite hatred against minority populations, Moore said in a statement. The SBC denomination has been engulfed in a debate over race in recent months, especially since Southern Baptist leaders condemned critical race theory, an academic movement that views racism as central to society's problems. Several black pastors have left the denomination, and prominent Bible teacher Beth Moore revealed last week that she has also parted ways with it. Long's Church is part of a group in the SBC called Founders Ministries that has pushed the convention in a more conservative direction in recent years. The group has described white fragility as racism and called critical race theory godless and materialistic ideologies. Tom Askell, president of Founders Ministries, said he does not know the Crabapple Church and that it lists itself voluntarily. He pointed to a disclaimer on the group's website that states that it is not able to evaluate and endorse each church. Josh Buis, the Georgia-based founder of G3 Ministries and part of a group that opposes social justice efforts, said that he is not concerned with that movement's connections to Crabapple and Long, or how the movement's rhetoric might be used in the future to foment further violence. "We would never align with anyone that would, justify the murderous acts, the terroristic acts, the racist acts against individuals like that," he said. Buis said he would reject him as a Christian altogether. "A broken clock is right twice a day, and so an individual can say the right things in one statement and turn right around and absolutely deny the gospel, not only by what he states, but also by how he behaves himself and engages in life by his own actions," he said. And that's apparently what this guy has done. Raymond Chang, a Korean-American who is head of the Asian American Christian Collaborative, said he was disappointed but not surprised to learn that Long was an SBC member. "One of the things that is difficult about white evangelical Christian churches and spaces is that they struggle to talk about race and racism in any meaningful way and create conditions in which racism and white supremacy can sadly flourish," said Chang, campus minister at Wheaton College, an evangelical school outside Chicago. Chang said people of color within white evangelical spaces who try to help on issues of race are often silenced or pushed out, or they burn out. "A lot of people wouldn't be surprised that he came out of an SBC church," Chang said. "They need to wrestle with whether they had a part systematically in the long chain of discipleship of producing someone that could do something like this." Duke Kwan, a Korean-American pastor at Grace Meridian Hill in Washington, said that during the past year, members of his church have expressed fear about appearing in public, citing rhetoric that has attached the coronavirus spread to Asian Americans. "Even if it took place in Atlanta, there's the sense that this could be my grandmother, my brother, my sister," Kwan said. He said he was disappointed the suspect had a connection to a Christian church. "Again and again, we see different versions of an insidious relationship between racism and perversions of Christian faith," Kwan said. Owen Lee, pastor of a large majority Asian American church, Christ Central Presbyterian in Centerville, Virginia, said his 17-year-old son texted him Wednesday morning, "Dad, why are they killing our people?" "What do you say to your son?" Lee said. He said he was grateful that his non-Asian American friends messaged him to ask how he was doing and to say that they stand with him. "Asians are created in the image of God, worthy of respect and kindness," he said. "It feels ridiculous that we would even have to articulate that." Our next article this week comes from the March 14th issue of the New York Times. This is headlined, "Clergy Preach Faith in the COVID Vaccine to Doubters." The subheadline, "With widespread immunity essential to ending the pandemic, priests, imams, rabbis, and swamis are successfully urging their congregations to get the shots. Many people trust them more than they trust health officials." And this is by Jan Hoffman of the New York Times. During a recent Sunday service at The Gathering Place, an evangelical church in Orlando, Florida, the Reverend Gabriel Saguero focused his sermon on the COVID-19 vaccine and the fear and suspicion that his largely Latino congregation clutches so tightly. He turned to the New Testament, the parable of the Good Samaritan, about the importance of aiding the stranger. "In getting yourself vaccinated, you are helping your neighbor," he preached to about 300 masked and socially distanced worshipers. "God wants you to be whole so you can care for your community. So think of vaccines as part of God's plan." Mr. Salguero is among thousands of clergy members from a cross-section of faiths, imams, rabbis, priests, and swamis, who are trying to coax the hesitant to get vaccinated against COVID-19. By weaving scripture with science, they are employing the singular trust vested in them by their congregations to dispel myths and disinformation about the shots. Many are even offering their sanctuaries as vaccination sites to make the experience more accessible and reassuring. Their mission is becoming increasingly vital. With vaccine supply expected to surge in the coming months, and the White House promising enough doses for every American adult by May, public health officials are shifting their attention to the still substantial number of people who are skeptical about the vaccines. Winning them over is imperative if the country is to achieve widespread immunity from the virus and a semblance of normalcy. Some of the most potent reasons people cite in resisting vaccines are rooted in religious beliefs, and indeed one obstacle these clergy members face is the inveighing against the shots by their own peers. The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops recently proclaimed that Catholics should avoid the Johnson & Johnson vaccine if they have a choice, calling it morally compromised because it was developed with cell lines from a fetus aborted in 1985. A false rumor, taken up by some imams and rabbis, that COVID-19 vaccines contain pork byproducts pervades Muslim and Jewish communities. But clergy members who believe in the importance of vaccines are uniquely positioned to counter these claims. Pope Francis himself declared the coronavirus shots are morally acceptable because of the severity of the pandemic and the remoteness of the connection to the aborted fetus. With Ramadan approaching next month, imams have been holding Facebook live chats with Muslim doctors, organized around questions like, is the COVID-19 vaccine halal? Albert Mohler, the influential president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, announced that he would take the vaccine. In YouTube videos, WhatsApp messages, and podcasts, some ultra-Orthodox rabbinical scholars in Israel and Brooklyn are endorsing the vaccine, citing religious texts. Evangelical clerical activism that promotes vaccination, led by ministers like Mr. Salguero, is gaining momentum. This month, a national network of Latino evangelical pastors hosted a webinar in Spanish about vaccines with government medical experts. In the Biden administration, the clergy has a new partner. The newly reinstated White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships has been holding a weekly call with thousands of faith leaders across the country on strategies for working with clinics to administer the shots. During the March 4th call, Jared Moskowitz, director of the Florida Division of Emergency Management, who is connected with churches in Florida's Cuban, Haitian, and Vietnamese communities, said that faith leaders were crucial in getting vaccines to their communities. There are major trust issues, there are major transportation issues, and there are digital divide issues, Mr. Moskowitz said, and what the church community has done is solve all of those issues. Congregations, he said, know the pastor, they trust the pastor, and the pastor is better than anybody at getting people to come out. Que lo prohíben, let them prove it. That is the throwdown retort from parishioners that Mr. Salguero hears when he brings up COVID-19 vaccines. His congregation includes African Americans and multi-generational families from 20 countries throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. Members range from people who can't read to doctors and other highly educated professionals. The virus has swept through the church as well as the pastor's family, him, his wife, his sister, both sons. Still, many in the congregation are steeped in myths about the vaccine and in real-life experiences of unequal medical care. Mr. Salguero, who is of Puerto Rican descent and mindful of the history of medical abuse of Latino people, including decades of forced sterilization of Puerto Rican women, urges parishioners to ask as many questions as they want about the vaccine. The queries pour forth. If you're undocumented, can the vaccine be used to track you? If you're not a citizen, can you still get it? Is the vaccine a mark of the beast, a reference to the heralding of the end times in the Book of Revelation? Though Mr. Salguero is full of facts, he has moderated national town halls with experts from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, he tries to buoy them with biblical context. Yes, there is balm in Gilead. Our tradition is rich with Christ the healer, he said, and medicine is one way people are healed. In January, Swayam Prakash Swami, a former medical doctor based in India who is now a senior monk affiliated with BAPS, a mainstream Hindu denomination, gave his blessing to the COVID-19 shots. Now the ancient Hindu principle of ahimsa, an exhortation to do no harm and revere life, is being used to encourage Hindus in North America to embrace the vaccine, said Dr. Kashyap Patel, a cardiologist in Atlanta who is a medical advisor to BAPS. American Hindu temples such as the BAPS Sri Swaminarayan Mandir in Melville, New York, are providing pop-up vaccine clinics to their communities. Vaccine hesitance is more entrenched among American Muslims, who number nearly 3.5 million. About a quarter of them are African Americans, who have their own historic reasons for mistrusting the shots. Hagar Abu Bakr, who runs an Islamic school in Howard County, Maryland, said she saw no reason to get the COVID vaccine. But as she learned of teachers at her school being vaccinated, she thought, I have a responsibility to lead by example. Am I being selfish by not getting it? She offered a supplication prayer, asking Allah to lead her to a good decision. She listened to talks by Muslim physicians. She consulted her imam. He told her, Muslim scholars advise you to take it. As Muslims, it is our responsibility to do what we need to do to relieve humanity of this pandemic. Ms. Abu Bakr recently got her first shot. Imams worldwide have been appearing in live-streamed conversations with doctors from the Islamic Medical Association of North America. In the talks, Dr. Usman Sayed, an infectious disease physician, explains vaccine science but then turns to religious commentary. Medicine has long been a firmament of Islam, she says, citing a narration about the Prophet Muhammad, who was asked if taking medicine for disease was permitted. Yes, O you servants of Allah, take medicine, as Allah has not created a disease without creating a cure, except for one. Which one? They asked. He replied, old age. Although many Hasidic communities have defied COVID public health guidelines and oppose mandatory vaccinations generally, most Jewish denominations typically endorse them. Some synagogues have offered to host interfaith COVID-19 vaccine pop-up sites and to help staff mobile vaccination clinics. But even some mainstream rabbis have been facing fresh questions about the COVID shots. It's a Jewish mandate to take whatever life-saving measures are necessary, even in the case of potential risk, answers Rabbi Adir Posey of Beth Jacob, an Orthodox synagogue in Beverly Hills, who is also a leader of the Orthodox Union, a network of congregations. Centuries ago, he said, rabbis defended the novel smallpox vaccine by ruling that you can enter into a small risk in order to avoid a bigger one down the line. For some people, that religious argument helps move the needle a little, Rabbi Posey said, so to speak. Just the thought of the COVID vaccine made Carolyn Love stiffen up. Dr. Love, who is a consultant on corporate diversity and inclusion programs and is black, is well aware that people of color have been treated dismissively by the healthcare system, and she herself holds it at arm's length. But to find out more, she attended vaccine information sessions led by black physicians. When she heard that Shorter Community AME Church in Denver, her faith home of 40 years, was offering the vaccine, that made the difference. Black churches have formed pandemic-fighting national networks with a single-mindedness that mirrors their embrace of civil rights issues. A Florida task force led by black churches has linked arms with historically black colleges and universities, offering sanctuaries as vaccination sites. The Black Coalition Against COVID-19 put out guidelines for faith leaders with tips about the pandemic and vaccination. The Reverend Matthew L. Watley of Kingdom Fellowship AME Church in Silver Spring, Maryland, which shares vaccine information with congregations nationwide, bluntly confronts the black community's deep-seated vaccine distrust. The ultimate conspiracy could be wait until there's a global pandemic that's disproportionately affecting African Americans and then convince them to not take the one medical intervention that's proven to save lives. At Shorter, the Reverend Dr. Timothy Tyler has spoken on vaccination in his online service, participating in panels, and posted about his shots on Facebook. Now, when UC Health, the healthcare system affiliated with the University of Colorado, sends word that it will administer 500 doses at Shorter on a Sunday, church members hit the phones, cajoling older members offering transportation. On a recent Sunday, after a hard year of being away from church, Dr. Love stepped back into Shorter to get her vaccine. She hailed pewmates she hadn't seen in too long. Kneeling before the sanctuary altar, she wept. I prayed for those who did not have the opportunity I was blessed with, and for a healing for our nation, she said. Then she headed into the church's Omar D. Blair Fellowship Hall, named for a Tuskegee Airman who became a civil rights advocate. This is where she had led Girl Scout activities, where the church celebrated her husband after he had passed. Now, a new milestone. She sat down at a table to receive the shot, hopeful that it would help deliver her from the pandemic, restore her to the communal life she cherishes. As she rolled up her sleeve, she looked around. This was so much better than a doctor's office, she thought. We've got just a couple more minutes on this week's edition of Religion in the News. We'll finish up with this article from the Jerusalem Post, dated March 19th. Iceland recognizes Judaism as an official state religion. The country has only one rabbi, Avi Feldman, who initiated the Shabbat Lubavitch of Iceland in 2018. Feldman and the community have worked hard to gain Iceland's formal approval. This is by Hadassah Brenner of the Jerusalem Post. Iceland has finally recognized Judaism as a religion. The process took over a year, and despite being home to a small Jewish community, Iceland has never before acknowledged the religion. Recognition was finally awarded on March 8th. The country has only one rabbi, Avi Feldman, who initiated the Chabad Lubavitch of Iceland in 2018. Feldman and the community members have worked hard to gain Iceland's formal approval of their presence. For Iceland to formally recognize the world's oldest religion is in itself very significant, Feldman explained. The decision is so significant because it allows Jews to pay taxes toward their own religious institutions. Jewish marriages, baby naming, and funerals will also be accepted by the civil law. While once Iceland was mostly isolated, immigration to the country has steadily increased. Some of these immigrants are Jews who escaped northward during and after the Holocaust. According to Jewish community member Julian Burgos, after World War II, Jews began coming here in small numbers, but it was always a small community. When Rabbi Feldman first arrived in Iceland, the Jewish community had merely 100 members. However, we meet local Jews whom we didn't know previously every single week, he said. Since then, the rabbi has found at least 300. While most of the Jews live in the country's largest city, Reykjavik, the rabbi said he has discovered scattered populations in the smaller cities of Akureyri and Westfjord. There are even Jews living in some of the fishing villages in the country's outskirts. With the growth of the Jewish community, Feldman has fought to support its culture and community in Iceland. The country's first Holocaust memorial service was held in January 2020. Soon after that, the community danced through the street with their first Torah scroll. A menorah was erected on Hanukkah in the city center. This official approval of Judaism will help Jewish life here grow and become even more active, Feldman exclaimed. His wife, Mushki, added, "The Jewish people of Iceland have waited a long time for this to happen. The determination of the people in the community to get this done is really impressive. There's a bright future for Jews under the Northern Lights." We've run out of time for this week on Religion in the News. We certainly hope you've enjoyed it, and thank you very much for tuning in. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Don't forget that podcasts of this and other episodes of Religion in the News are available on our website. Just visit ncreadingservice.org, click the Listen tab, and select the podcast section. We'll talk to you next time. This has been Religion in the News from the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.